and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. This past weekend, Russians went to the polls for the country's presidential election. To the surprise of no one, Vladimir Putin emerged victorious with a record high 87% of the vote and record high turnout. Of course, there was no actual competition. Alexei Navalny was killed in prison, and the anti-war candidate Boris Nadezhdin was barred from running as he and his messaging became a little too popular for the Kremlin's liking. Despite the fraudulent nature of the election, though, Putin is still likely to take this result as evidence of a popular mandate to continue his policies of repression at home and aggression abroad, especially as Russia remains on the offensive in Ukraine. To discuss Putin's fifth term in office and what we should expect, we're very happy to have with us Angela Stent and Joshua Yaffa with us today. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad to be on again.
Angela is senior advisor to the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies and professor emerita of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. She's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-chairs its Hewitt Forum on Post-Soviet Affairs. And she's also the author of the excellent book, Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. And Joshua is a contributing writer for The New Yorker. He's also the author of Between Two Fires, Truth, Ambition, and Compromise in Putin's Russia, published in January 2020 by Tim Dugan Books, and which won the Orwell Prize in 2021, and which is a fantastic read for anyone who hasn't already read it. Joshua, also authored, we were just talking, a really wonderful piece in The New Yorker ahead of the election titled, Has Putin's Invasion of Ukraine Improved His Standing in Russia? And you paint a picture in that piece of what the mood is like in Russia in the run-up to the election. Maybe we can start with your sense of what Russians are thinking about the war and Putin. Kind of give us a sense of, we always say on this podcast, the mood music, the context in which this election took place.
Sure. I'm happy to try. And I should emphasize the word try in that we're all doing this now at a great remove from Russia. I'm talking to you from Berlin. Still have access to lots of people in Russia. Things like Telegram, Zoom make it possible, right? But that kind of tactile, impressionistic, anecdotal feel is harder to get these days. So anything that I say should be caveated by saying that first. But I think we can say some big things about the state of Russian society and how people relate to the war, to politics, and so on. And there's been a few different reactions, some of which have taken place, you know, kind of in parallel, concurrently within the same person. Some of them people choose kind of different reactions. But, you know, there's on the one hand, you have people, the tendency to try and, in a way, ignore the war, to continue with life as usual. And largely, that's pretty possible, actually. The mobilization, of course, which called up 300,000 plus soldiers, affected a lot of people. But in a country of 140 million people, not so much, where, you know, everyday life, the fabric of everyday life was disrupted for a large swath of the population. It wasn't. Mobilization passed. Those who didn't get the draft notice could, if they so chose, continue to live as if, you know, life went on as it had before. That takes an extraordinary amount of psychic effort, but Russians are used to that. Russians are used to expending a lot of psychic effort so as to create a sort of bubble in which they live their own lives. They and their families live their own kind of private, atomized, disconnected existence, disconnected from their other citizens in terms of a lack of horizontal ties, and certainly disconnected from politics writ large, over which they feel little connection, little responsibility, a tendency I talk about in the piece, and this maybe segues to another adaptive mechanism. Here I'm citing the really wonderful and insightful political philosopher Greg Yudin, who talked about how for many Russians, there's a kind of backwards calculation, or it's backwards to compared to what we think of in the West as how people act based on what they think. And you didn't talk to me about how he often gets faces some surprise from Western audiences who ask him, you know, why if Russians are so upset, or if Russians don't like the war, if Russians don't like Putin, like, why aren't they going out and protesting? Why aren't they in the streets? And Yudin's response to that is, well, that gets the kind of causal relationship backwards here, in that it's not that if people have a certain attitude, then they act on that attitude. It's rather that if action is impossible, then the attitude becomes impossible. And you could look at that, that's either hopeful, that's either good news or bad news, right? For the moment, that's, we can call that kind of bad news, because the action is so objectively impossible, and we just can see the degree to which the Putin state has revved up its repressive apparatus. Well, therefore, the attitude becomes impossible too. And I think that sort of psychological coping mechanism is really important to understand. There have been some noticeable rally around the flag effects, if that's what we want to call them, that Russians over time, and we see this showing up in polls, places like the Levada Center. I quote in that New Yorker essay you mentioned some really wonderful research done by the Public Sociology Laboratory, a group of Russian researchers that have been doing focus groups over the last 2 years.
One of the more interesting bits in the piece, yeah.
Right. So there you see, among other attitudes, but one attitude that emerges is people who are initially shocked, horrified, maybe even we could classify as against the war, come around to feel like Russia is under attack internationally, diplomatically, geopolitically, that this idea that it really is, that the war in Ukraine is actually a war against Russia, that's something that has penetrated the Russian psyche over the last 2 years. You also see an attitude of, we may not have liked how this began, but this can't end in total defeat for Russia. I think that, I want to say that that's an understandable attitude, in the sense that I think, if we're being honest, lots of people in Western societies could feel something similar. That's not a uniquely Russian sentiment, that in a way, after 2 years of war, the origin story of the war gets kind of lost. And now it just feels like, because it's true, your country is at war. And when your country is at war, it feels scary to think about your country losing that war. So you end up, in a way, rooting for, if not victory, at least not defeat of your own country. And then lastly, the war has become just sort of routine, normalized for some segments of Russian society. It's something that just happens in the background of life, kind of like at a certain point, I think happened with the pandemic. You know, the pandemic went from being something that was this kind of the defining crisis of our lives, around which we oriented our entire lives. And after a year or two, it faded into the background. Other parts of life were happening in the context of the pandemic, and we adjusted accordingly, but we were no longer every day in some state of shock or emergency response. And I think a lot of Russians, again, understandably, predictably, not exclusive to the Russian condition. I'm not sure there's much that's like uniquely Russian happening here. I think that Russians are responding to the war in a number of ways that are kind of predictably human and predictably universal in a lot of ways.
And yet there were some signs of discontent and opposition. And so we saw the noontime voting. There was obviously the massive outpouring of support and condolence for Navalny, with the mound of flowers on his grave, even, you know, right before the election. There was the, I think, maybe surprising to the Kremlin, level of support and popularity of Nadezhdin that kind of caused them to bar him from the election. So, Angela, how do you interpret, I mean, that's the hard thing, I think, that we're all struggling with, right? And trying to understand how stable is this regime. There is everything that Joshua just talked about, but there are also these signs of discontent and opposition. And so how are you interpreting those indicators?
So I would say that it's what happened in the last few weeks shows us that civil society in Russia is still alive. It may not be well, but there are enough people of all ages, if you look at the videos, who were willing to go to attend Navalny's funeral or put flowers on his grave for days, or memorials to him all around Russia, even though the CCTV cameras obviously captured all of them and the authorities know they're there. The same with Nadezhdin. If he got the 200,000 signatures, there were lines of people queuing up to sign that petition for a candidate who was against the war, who didn't get on the ballot. Again, the authorities know who they are, and we'll see what happens to them. And what's interesting to me is we're now having reports from some Russian independent election observers. There were no, you know, independent international election observers there. There may have been some people from post-Soviet states, but not in the OSCE or anything like that. And those Russians are reporting fairly severe violations. You can see videos now of ballot stuffing. You had the people who during the election were setting fires in the polling stations, pouring green ink down the ballot boxes. I mean, quite a few instances of that. But what these independent Russian observers report is incompetent election officials. And then, you know, people sneaking in at the end and stuffing the ballot boxes, people not counting votes properly. And so I think we should take with a huge grain of salt the 87% figure. We have really no idea. I believe that Putin was probably re-elected, although we should call this, you know, a special election operation instead of an election. He was, but probably not with those figures. And I think what the Kremlin would take away from this is that there are people who are still unafraid to say that they oppose the war and that they oppose Putin, including all of the people who showed up at noon on Sunday in Russia. Of course, thousands more showed up abroad in Berlin, where Joshua is, and other places, but in Russia. And so this is why I'm concerned that after this process is over, as it is now, there will be even greater repression in Russia, that Putin and the Kremlin will try and suppress whatever of the civil society that's not afraid to express itself is there. And I think there'll be more clampdowns on things like the internet, some of the other social media sites. There are rumors that they're going to try and the Kremlin do away with the VPNs. I don't know whether that's technically possible. I'm not an expert. But I think that could be a result of civil society in Russia bravely showing its face in the past few weeks.
Yeah, told Putin that the opposition is still there. They haven't fully stamped it out. And so you think he's going to, and I agree, move to really tamp it down. But Joshua, you were going to add.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on Angela's point, especially going back to the phenomena of Nadezhdin's candidacy and Navalny's funeral and talking about this idea that civil society, as Angela correctly put it, is alive but not well. And it's really interesting to think about those two phenomena and what we didn't see on the other side, which is any sort of genuine grassroots, something we could call kind of authentic mobilization for Putin. And so even though there's very little ability for those with, let's call them kind of opposition viewpoints, anti-Putin, anti-war, there are very little mechanisms, in fact, basically zero mechanisms for those attitudes to actually lead to change in the political arena. That's what we can, in a way, give Putin credit for. He has successfully kind of denuded or disarmed the political system so that those attitudes have no outlet. There's no place for them to go. But I think it's important to note that actually, if we're talking about what Russians are willing to do based on their own feelings, motives, not because their boss at a municipal office told them to or they were put on a bus, but genuinely willing to spend their own time doing, go out into the streets on their own will, that's something like give signatures for Nadezhdin or go to Navalny's funeral. I don't want to turn that into false hope about the potential strength of the opposition and its ability to affect real change. I don't see that on the horizon, again, because there's really no link between those sentiments and anything and kind of formal levers of power in the political system. But it is worth noting that we have these data points to see that given the right circumstances, there are a lot of people actually who are willing to band together and participate in something that we can call vaguely oppositionist. And there are actually a lot more of them maybe than there are people willing to, in an authentic, genuine way, band together and do something in defense of the regime. We also saw that, for example, during the Prigozhin mutiny this summer when no one lifted a finger to protect Putin during Prigozhin's short-lived march to Moscow. So right now, these are nothing more than data points. Again, I'm not predicting in any way the fall of the regime. It's still quite strong. But I think it's interesting to pay attention to things like this when we try and talk about, do Russians support Putin? Do they support the war? What does that word even mean? I think it's maybe more appropriate to talk about a word like tolerate. But one can tolerate a situation even when you don't like for a very, very long time. So maybe that's the kind of bad news at the end of what might have sounded like a bit of good news.
A quick follow up, and then Jim, I'll let you jump in. But so that Mike, you know, I think there's some kind of, I don't know, debate's not the right word, but a sense that Putin is moving Russia in a more totalitarian direction. People are throwing that term around more and more. And that obviously implies a certain level of mobilization of society in support of the regime's objectives. And I guess your point is so correct, Joshua, about like there, with all of these instances, there isn't a genuine kind of pro-regime mobilization. Is it your sense that Putin is trying to mobilize society in support of this larger confrontation, not just with Ukraine, with the West? Or, you know, because traditional Putin, I think, very much enjoyed the apathy of society and having people not involved in politics. What's your, you know, how do you read that? Do you think that he is trying to mobilize Russians in support of this war and this confrontation?
So I think during the election campaign, it looked as if that's what they were trying to do. I mean, they had these, you know, they got these groups of people together, young people in costumes, uniforms, whatever. They made these speeches. They tried, I think, to mobilize people. It didn't seem very effective to me. And, you know, so I think there's an ambivalence there because it suits Putin if people are apathetic or, you know, as Josh has said, they just want to get on with their lives and they want to put the war out, you know, out of their minds and pretend that it's not happening because then they're less likely to have active opposition. But I think you point to something very important. I do think that Putin is moving Russia towards, I don't know if I'd use the word totalitarian. There is still no real ideology as there was, you know, under Stalin. But he's certainly moving it back more to what it looked like under Stalin, just in terms of the repression, the denunciations of people, you know, just the way that they're treating people. Plus, of course, if you read some of the things and listen to what Putin says about Ukraine, it sounds rather like Hitler, in fact, using phrases from him. But having said that, I'm not sure how much the Kremlin really wants to mobilize society. I think they'd rather, you know, they want to be able to draft people. They don't want people to actively oppose what they're doing. But they, you know, if they mobilize them, then people may think more about the consequences of what they're doing. And that could lead to something unanticipated for them.
Yeah, I agree with basically all of that. And I think that the word ambivalence that Angela used to talk about the Kremlin strategy is the right one. And I might even take it further and say, I'm not sure that there is a coherent strategy. That's actually true with just about everything in Putinism, that it's pretty improvisational and ad hoc. I mean, you have to give it its credit. It's now going on 24 years. So whatever it's doing, it's clearly working for it. But on the one hand, yes, Putin would like society to be more involved. I think first and foremost, because psychologically, less even politically, but really psychologically for him, I think it's important that this war, he believes this war is not something that he launched on his own whim and dragged the country into, but rather he's somehow expressing the will of the nation and this is the people's war. I think that that's psychologically important for him. And that's why you see him talking, for example, the State of the Union address about not just the sacrifices of those on the front, but people sewing camouflage nets and participating in other volunteer activities. He would like this to be a people's war. But on the other hand, he's not really forcing the issue. And I think that, like Angela said, there's actually a lot of comfort for the Kremlin in having the public remained apathetic, disengaged, atomized, basically outsource, leave matters of politics to the state. That's, of course, a more habitual and comfortable position for the state. So I think Putin doesn't know what he wants, really. One minute he wants this to be a people's war with everyone involved, not just those at the front, everyone doing their duty. And on another moment, he wants people to leave the political sphere, certainly matters of war and peace, to him and to his ruling the small number of ruling elite, just the way it always has been. And I don't know if that problem or circle is ever going to be squared. I predict that Putin will continue to muddle through this question. We'll see mobilization in some spheres. We'll see a continued reliance on demobilization in others. And I don't know if Putin or the regime will ever make a bet on one or the other. It can't really. On the mobilization question, basically, it can't, because at least of right now, we don't see a country that's willing to be mobilized. We don't see people flocking to stadiums to burn American books or Ukrainian flags or whatever the case may be. The numbers simply aren't there. Does Putin want to mobilize the country fully by force? So far, no.
Can I add one thing? It's almost the opposite. What message was Putin and the other people in the Kremlin giving to Russian women? Forget about going to college. Forget about studying and working. Go home and have lots of children, because that's, you know, your patriotic duty. And by the way, we need these children. That's hardly a message of mobilizing at least the female part of the population.
Well, thank you very much. I'm thoroughly enjoying hearing your views. And I just want to, you've touched on this a little bit, but I thought I'd just go ahead and ask the question, because I think a lot of our listeners were probably wondering this when they were watching the flowers being laid on the graves and watching the flocking to the voting places at noon and all these acts of civil disobedience, peacefully, and I'm sure they're all asking themselves, I wonder if Putin really cares what they're doing. Does this make him suddenly concerned? Does this, these acts, does this, move the needle at all in the Kremlin, where he might get a little, a little nervous or whatever? Or does he just doesn't care? He feels confident enough that where he's going, he feels confident enough that this kind of thing isn't going to undercut him. And as he looked at the TV, he shrugged his shoulders and changed the channel to watch something else. So do you think he cares? Is there anything that actually does make him nervous?
I think everything makes him nervous. I'll maybe even just leave it there and turn it over to Angela in a second. But I think that the thing about Putin is that this is someone, the dichotomy or the yin and yang of paranoia and confidence, even overconfidence, is actually definitive to Putin's personality. So everything makes Putin nervous. He's way more nervous about lots of things than objectively one should say should, like that in terms of real threats to his power. So on the one hand, he sees threats everywhere. He sees certainly threats to his personal power, maybe even personal safety, more than they actually exist. But he can also be overly confident and overly serene in his own abilities at the same time. I don't know if that's a satisfying answer. Perhaps Angela has a better way of solving that riddle.
So, I mean, I really agree with Joshua. I mean, the one person who obviously really made him nervous, even though he didn't have a huge support among the Russian population, was Alexei Navalny. And that's why, slowly they poisoned him and then they slowly killed him and put him in the Arctic Circle. And for the first time, Putin mentioned Navalny's name after he was dead, and in a very cynical way, saying, well, it's too bad that he died, but then people die in prisons in the United States as well, yeah. And, other countries. I do think that Putin would like to feel that he has absolute power. And I think that's why they don't like the fact that these people turned up both after Navalny died to sign the petition for Nadezhdin and then for these protests on Sunday, the noon protests. So I don't think he feels that his rule is threatened, but he would like to get rid of those people and not have them do what they're doing. His main goal now is staying in power, because he doesn't quite know what would happen to him if he wasn't in power anymore. If he were removed not by natural causes. And so that's his goal. And he sees the war as this is the part of this, as the end of what he's trying to do. And really what you see before the election and afterwards, this is now the national cause. I mean, I said before, they don't have an ideology, but what they do have is, this is a patriotic war. It's like fighting the Nazis, in World War II. And we have to win it, because it's an existential question for us. And I think on some level, he believes that.
Yeah, that's a good point. On the kind of the personalist dictators, just like with the political science research. They, I mean, they are, Angela, as you just mentioned, the most likely to be jailed, exiled, or killed. And they're, because like lacking succession plans and everything else, tend to be the most paranoid. But the thing I find so interesting is there is this paranoia and to some degree sense of insecurity on the domestic front. And that juxtaposes quite sharply with what I think what he portrays and is projecting internationally. Mm-hmm. And so talk a little bit about, maybe Angela, start with you, kind of like your sense of how Putin is feeling about his like international standing and what he's accomplishing on the foreign policy realm in Ukraine, but I think even more broadly.
So I think at the moment we can talk more about Ukraine. You know, Putin believes that Russia's winning, that Ukraine is more on the defensive. You have this terrible debate in the United States about, you know, the paralysis in the Congress. Are we going to continue supporting Ukraine or not? And from Putin's point of view, if we don't continue supporting Ukraine, then the game is more or less over, although obviously Europeans are doing, they're trying to step up and do more. So I think he feels he just has to wait out 2024 and that he thinks Russia will be in a much more advantageous position at the end of 2024. He's awaiting, of course, the November presidential election in the United States. And I think otherwise, he certainly projects an image of confidence. I mean, what can we say? He's about to go to North Korea, one of his new allies, right? I mean, now that Russia has cultivated this axis of resistance, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. Now we can question, okay, what kind of an ally is North Korea? But Putin has seen objectively since the Russia-Ukraine war began, Russia's standing in much of what we, for a better word, call the global South, increase. And that's been intensified by Russia's reaction to the Israel-Hamas war, where Russia has supported Hamas, supported the Palestinians, distanced Russia from Israel, despite the fact that before, you know, Putin and Netanyahu had a fairly close relationship. And that, again, has made Russia more popular in large parts of the world, including the global South. And so I think the BRICS are now expanding. The Saudi Arabians are still deciding whether they're going to join or not, but you have an expanded BRICS. We can talk about what the BRICS actually do, but from Putin's standpoint, here's another multilateral organization from which the West is excluded, where Russia and China, you know, have a leading role. And the relationship with China has gotten closer. Whatever the asymmetries and the issues there, China supports Russia, has supported Russia since the beginning of the Ukraine war. Xi Jinping does not want Putin to lose this war because he fears the consequences if Putin were replaced by someone else with that new Russian leader, hard as it is to imagine, rethink Russia's foreign policy and maybe want some kind of a rapprochement with the West. I'm not sure that the Chinese want the Russians to completely win the war. In other words, take over all of Ukraine and have regime change there, because then we don't know what Russia would do afterwards. And so the Chinese always worry about stability, instability in their backyard and other places in the globe. But in general, I think in terms of his relations with foreign countries, Putin's feeling pretty good. Yes, he's isolated from the West, but he's not isolated from much of the rest of the world.
Richard Fontaine and I have a piece coming out in the next Foreign Affairs on that. We call it the axis of upheaval. So hopefully that'll be a sticky term that sticks.
I look forward to reading that. Yeah.
But Joshua, you go ahead and add.
Sure. You know, one can, for example, make fun of Russia having to slum it diplomatically with relations with North Korea. But if North Korea is providing millions of artillery shells that have, among other supplies, including increased Russian production, given Russia in recent months a quite formidable advantage in artillery power on the battlefield in Ukraine, which has, among other things, allowed Russia to push forward and take new territory for the first time in some time in the war. Capture of Avdiivka, of course, was a key battle, if not in terms of battlefield dynamics, certainly psychologically, image-wise, I think that was very important for both sides. So we can laugh all we want, but these relationships are paying dividends where it really matters, which is on the ground in Ukraine, balance of forces, who's able to hold territory, who's able to take territory. And so I think we have to be pretty clear-eyed about, you know, we may laugh at who Russia is kind of reduced to rubbing shoulders with diplomatically, but for the issues that for the issue that really matters, I think, at the top of the global agenda, and that's the war in Ukraine and its outcome. Those relationships may actually bear fruit. Iran certainly, no less important with drone production and other things. Going back to this dichotomy of security, insecurity, confidence, paranoia, I think it's true on the global front, or rather on the in Ukraine, the Ukrainian theater, the war there. On the one hand, as Angela has talked about and it's been clearly documented, I think this is objectively true, that momentum advantage is on the Russian side. We can see that certainly with the rate of artillery fire. We can see that in terms of who is amassing troops, whether or not Russia tries another large-scale offensive action, we shall see. But Avdiivka certainly, again, was symbolically a symbolic key battle. But it would be fair to say momentum does appear to be on the Russian side, and the West isn't really doing anything that large. I mean, look at the dysfunction in Washington. It would be hard to say that American policymakers are doing something particularly formidable or large scale to try and counteract what clearly looks like a shift of momentum to the Russian side. And I'm not sure that independent European efforts will be enough to counteract that either. So Putin definitely feels like, and may actually be correct in feeling, that time is on his side. This will be an advantageous year for Russia. I mentioned this in the essay, and for the New Yorker, a member of the Russian elite, talking about how Putin feels like he can wait because every passing week, every passing month, the situation only gets worse for Ukraine and more advantageous for Russia. So the waiting game really plays into Putin's favor, and he sees the way that Russia has been able to reorient its economy, certainly not to the benefit of Russian people. Things like healthcare, education are being starved to pay for war industry, but that war industry is producing shells, producing munitions that is giving Russia this advantage I'm talking about. So Putin, I don't think, is wrong to think that in a way time is on his side, or appears to be on his side, unless the collective West does something dramatically different in the coming weeks than it's been doing in the first weeks of this year. There is a but, though, and I believe that Putin is nervous about this also because he sees it, which is that the West is not coming to its senses. And I think he's genuinely confused about this. From as far as he understands, it should have been clear to the West a long time ago the way this war is headed. It's pointless to keep throwing resources into Ukraine. Ukraine is a lost cause, and there's no reason for the West continue to spend money, treasure, and so on, and Ukraine to continue to see the loss of so many soldiers. This has all become so nonsensical that clearly the West should, and of course Putin doesn't believe an independent Ukrainian agency. As far as he's concerned, this is all for Washington to decide, not even European independent agency, really. This is just all a matter for Joe Biden himself to decide. So why isn't Biden doing the sensible, obvious thing and telling the Ukrainians, it's over, the war is over, you lost, you have to negotiate? That for Putin, that's so glaringly obvious. And I think it's, on the one hand, with every passing week, he feels like Russia's position is improving, but also with every passing week, I think he's becoming more and more confused and potentially aggravated, stressed, anxious about why is the West not doing what is so clearly the obvious and right move for it.
And I would imagine what Macron said a couple of days ago, and which continues to rattle around about, you know, ratcheting up European involvement with boots on the ground, however one might want to interpret just what does that really mean. That must be further frustrating and pissing Putin off if he feels that common sense tells you this needs to be sorted. And here the ante's upped by Macron, setting off this debate about what more does Europe need to be doing.
Sure. But then again, you can sort of pick your data points. That came off the heels of a leaked German conversation in which German officials were essentially ceding the sovereignty of Crimea to Russia and saying that, the use of German weapons to strike, for example, the Crimean bridge would be escalatory. So, I mean, there's a lot of mixed signals, to put it mildly, coming out of Europe. And of course, the idea of, European boots on the ground, however fantastical that sounds in Ukraine, certainly goes against Putin's logic, which is the West should clearly be interested in ending this war, not escalating it. I'm not sure that that's actually Western policy at this point. But Angela, I think, has a better read on those dynamics.
you know, to come back to Macron, let's not forget the kind of domestic European dimension of this. Germany and France are always rivals to see who can lead in policy toward Russia. Macron and Scholz do not enjoy a good relationship. And so Macron, who just a few years ago said NATO was brain dead and we shouldn't humiliate Putin, suddenly comes up with this phrase, but I'm sure that he's not talking about ground troops in Ukraine. He's probably talking about advisors, military advisors, or more military advisors. But still, it's got this, it's certainly got this debate going. I think Putin believed that he had successfully deterred the West from doing anything like that with his threats of nuclear escalation. And if you looked at the Biden administration has certainly not done certain things because it doesn't want to escalate. And the same has been true for the Europeans. And as Joshua said, with the debate in Germany over the Taurus missiles. And so I think what for Putin must be puzzling is that maybe his deterrence strategy, which seemed to have worked pretty well, is now being called into question. So I think the point of this is also to make him on edge. I mean, he's been so clever at getting all of the West guessing, what does he really mean? Let's not do this because he might use nuclear weapons. And now, if this can maybe cause him and the people in the Kremlin to be less sure about how effective they've been in deterring the West, I think that would be very salutary. But you do hear, you know, Putin talking now more and more about this is a war with NATO. And I should say, I mean, negotiations. I mean, Putin has said we won't negotiate until the Ukrainians accept our terms. But I also believe that Putin really wants to negotiate with the United States on some deal. I mean, he's hinted at that since the beginning of the war, the new Yalta, whatever it's going to be, that it's not just about Ukraine, but it's about Russia's rights as a great power, spheres of influence, all these things that we know about. But I think that's still in his mindset. And that's why he's waiting to see who's going to be the next U.S. president in January of 2025, because one of the candidates might be willing to negotiate such a deal with him.
Exactly.
Yeah, I want to pick up on the confidence bit. You know, we've talked about, you know, the fact that Putin is reshaping Russian society. He's shifted the economy to the wartime footing. He's doubling down on the partnerships with like-minded partners. And you just mentioned it, you know, the Putin phrases this increasingly as a war with NATO. I guess my question for you, Angela, is what do you actually think Putin's objectives, ultimate objectives are? And we talk about this all the time. There's just so much going on. But thinking about with what's happening in Moldova and all of the threats and efforts to destabilize Moldova, there's Armenia kind of pulling away and Russian efforts maybe dissatisfied with the direction that it's going. There's the non-strategic nuclear weapons, which there's now evidence that they have been transferred to Belarus and they're now there. And then all of these threats against NATO, coupled with this whole slew of warnings from senior European leaders about that, yes, we could see a NATO-Russia war, maybe not now, but pick your time frame between 2 and 7 years. I mean, what's your perspective on what you actually think Putin is trying to accomplish and where this is headed?
So his really long-term objective, but he may be too old to achieve it, is reversing the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, essentially not putting together the Soviet Union again, but reasserting Russia's right to a sphere of influence, certainly to its west, but also, I think, in the South Caucasus and to some extent in Central Asia as well. That's the long-term goal. The more short-term goal, it remains, in my opinion, to conquer Ukraine, to have regime change in Kyiv, and if not necessarily to militarily take Kyiv right now, the four annexed territories to make sure that those belong to Russia. But then I think he set his sights on Odessa. And we've seen that with some of the extreme, you know, bombing campaigns just in the last few weeks. Moldova, you mentioned. I mean, the Transnistrians asked for fraternal assistance or whatever from the Russians. The Russians haven't quite taken that up yet, but there's still much more instability. And what the Russians are trying to do is to support a coalition in the next Moldovan elections that will bring to power the pro-Russian parties, and not the current government in Moldova. So it's destabilizing the neighborhood, but I think in the immediate sense, it's at least getting Ukraine to surrender and to give Russia those four annexed territories, it's possible there could then be some kind of a ceasefire. But I think as long as he or someone like him is in power, they're not going to give up on subordinating Ukraine to Russia at a minimum. And then we can talk about, you know, if you go back to the 2021 treaties that were presented to NATO, you know, I think he still thinks of the former Warsaw Pact countries as countries that have a special relationship with Russia and, you know, shouldn't be in NATO. But I think that's more longer term.
Joshua, what's your sense on, you know, how all that sits with the Russian public and whether or not there's appetite to be and to remain engaged in this type of long-term confrontation?
I go back to this idea of a disengaged, atomized, depoliticized Russian public. And again, quote one of my favorite Russian thinkers, Greg Yudin, who was in this essay and shared the following idea that really resonated with me in a kind of terrifying way, but terrifying because I recognized its truth. And that is, on the one hand, if Putin were to come out tomorrow and say, our objectives in Ukraine have been achieved, we've denazified the country, whatever that means, you know, we've defeated NATO, the war is over, there would be certainly relief, if not outright joy in Russia. Because the public, and we can see this in various polling, this is showing up. The Russian public is exhausted, is tired of the war. There's a kind of latent desire for the war to end. I say latent because people aren't demanding it in the kind of way that we think of polities in the West, kind of demanding things of their governments. That's not how it works in Russia. But there is a degree of exhaustion. And I think Putin knows it. The Kremlin knows it. And that's not going to be the driving factor in Putin's decision. But he's aware that the country is tired of the war and would like it to end. And that will, at the margins, or maybe even more, weigh in to his decision making. But that said, the Russian public would be nothing but thrilled if he came out and said the war is over. But, and Yudin walked me through both of these scenarios, kind of explaining them in the context of a public that doesn't see itself as responsible, that doesn't see itself as kind of engaged or involved in these issues, right? That all of this is happening at a level far above or beyond them. That if Putin were to come out onto TV tomorrow and say, the conflict with the West is only escalating, the West is intent on Russia's destruction, Russia had no choice but to even, I don't know, send a nuclear warhead to Washington, the reaction would be, it wouldn't be joy, it would be panic, and it would be terror, as people tried to kind of understand what that meant for their own lives. But people would, in a way, accept that too. Like, there is no bottom, right? The regime can't count on Russian people's support in a genuine, mobilized way, but it also doesn't face a kind of break or limit on its behavior by the Russian public either. And so, again, we can choose to see the glass as half full or empty as a result, but there's sort of nothing on the more escalatory side of the spectrum that Putin could do that the Russian public would somehow reject or not accept and internalize, just like they've accepted and internalized everything else so far.
Yeah, that is really horrifying. That glass felt pretty empty to me. I'm not sure there was a full part of it, but it is such an interesting point. You know, and you just think about all of the kind of nuclear rhetoric on the talk shows and other things and the extent to which that changes people's tolerance about their willingness to tolerate Russia's use of a nuclear weapon. All of the political science research that talks about the importance of elite cues. I mean, this is something that people are getting a steady diet of this stuff. And
I mean, certainly the idea of a grand conflict with the West, I mean, that's already been normalized. I mean, that's already been introduced into the Russian public discourse. And if you look at, again, polling, Levada Center, other places, I mean, most Russians believe that this is actually a war between Russia and the West. So the messaging there has been successful. And so the idea that this is a big standoff, much larger than Ukraine, is something that already has been internalized and accepted by large portions of the Russian population.
Yeah, and in your article too, you quote someone as saying, you know, Russia's normally often at war. A lot of countries are at war. You know, this is normal.
But this bottomless idea, that really is horrifying. And I mean, I guess and it resonates with me as well. So, I hate to leave a podcast on such a gloomy and alarming note, but that's the way that our podcasts of late have tended to end. Not a lot of
we picked the wrong topic.
But wow, this was really wonderful. I so enjoyed the discussion. And so I just want to thank both of you for joining us and would love to check in the coming months about, you know, where things are actually headed in Putin's fifth term. So thank you very much.
Cool. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Brussels Sprouts, brought to you by the Transatlantic Security Team at the Center for a New American Security. You can find all of our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And please remember to rate and review Brussels Sprouts so that new listeners are able to find the show.